Are there any citizen comments? And if you do, please step to the podium with the microphone. Be sure the microphone is on. And state your case. Anyone? Citizen comments?
Did we get any by email or anything? Anybody?
All right, seeing no citizen comments, we'll move on. I have no committee. I have no reports, and are there any reports from the committee? Seeing none, the minutes of April 15th are before you, and is there any discussion?
Move to approve the minutes.
All right. Are there additions, corrections, or further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Opposed? It passes. We are now at number six, the discussion of possible motion regarding procedures for handling potential up-and-coming discipline appeal. All right, where's Joe? Oh, there you are. Okay, fine. All right. Yes. Joe, if the president says that if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear your mask, you've got... Perhaps at least if you want to speak without the mask on, it would be, we can understand you a little better, but I leave it up to you and your discretion.
If there are problems, please let me know. I did think about that on the way over. There is still a city ordinance in place. I think we're going to all be getting more guidance in the next couple of days. Obviously, this just came out today. So.
All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As I imagine most of you are aware, there has recently been a disciplinary matter involving the upper management of the Sheriff's Department. That discipline has been imposed. We are not speaking about the discipline itself or the fact of that case this evening. I would like to just briefly speak with you about procedure. This committee will serve, if an appeal is filed regarding that discipline, as the grievance committee. And we have been advised, Chairman Rose and myself, that that appeal is forthcoming. So this committee will serve as the grievance committee to hear that appeal. A number of you, although not all of you, have served in the past to hear other grievance appeals on employment matters. This is going to be different than those situations. In those previous cases, the committee has undertaken what I've sometimes referred to as a paper review. A situation has gone through a process of a hearing before an independent hearing officer, and then that decision comes before the Finance Committee for essentially determining whether that decision was rendered correctly, I guess. But it is just that, is a review of a decision made by an independent hearing officer. In this case, that would not be the situation. The situation is that this committee would actually hear a contested matter with testimony being taken from the various parties, and then essentially serve as a jury or the decision maker in that process. Counsel would appear advocating for the Sheriff's Department, presenting the facts that serve as the basis for the discipline. Counsel would also appear on behalf of the employee, arguing why that discipline is not appropriate. I am neither of those individuals. My job will be to serve as counsel to the committee and advise the committee through the process. So I'm not advocating for any particular outcome. Both sides have the opportunity not only to present their own case, but to cross-examine those witnesses that are called by the other side. After the evidence is presented, the committee will deliberate as to what the appropriate discipline, if any, should be. Just to get it out on the table, because it's a question that's been asked. Again, in a difference from some of the other grievance hearings that have been, or appeals that have been brought before the committee in the past, the committee has, I believe, a greater degree of discretion in determining what that outcome should be. It has to be consistent with the evidence. In a moment, we will distribute to the members of the committee copies of the determination made by the Sheriff's Department, as well as the supporting exhibits, including a report that was prepared as a result of an independent investigation. I am beseeching you that these must be kept confidential. Sergeant Beth has a right to object to any release of this information that the county might consider releasing before that release occurs. I understand some of this information is already out in the public. I understand some people may believe that I'm being overly sensitive or trying to close the barn door. Regardless, all I can control is the actions of the county, not individuals. And so again, I am urging you to please consider this information to be confidential until and unless you are provided with other instruction. You, like a jury, only should consider the information that's going to be provided to you as part of the hearing, as well as this report. Further, like a jury, I'm going to ask that you not discuss this matter outside of the hearing, conduct any individual investigation, seek information from other sources, or again, share any information you are learning until or unless you are advised that you are able to do so. You may want to consider keeping a log of any contacts that you have from persons seeking information about this matter. That's because I understand there's considerable interest, but we wish to ensure that the employees' rights are fully respected and protected as we move forward. Chairman Rose and I are going to be discussing procedural matters in regards to the hearing this coming Monday with the two attorneys that would be coming before you as advocates. What I'm asking from the committee tonight, number one, is guidance on scheduling, and I suspect that Chairman Rose may speak to that in just a second. I'm also looking for the authority for the chairman and I to deliver the complaint to the employee and to proceed with determining the procedures that we're going to use going forward. They are primarily directed by statute, but if there are any other issues that need to be dealt with. Once we have agreement between the parties on what those procedures are going to be, and prior to any hearing being scheduled, I will prepare a memo for the committee members outlining exactly how I expect the proceeding itself will go forward. So with that, I'm happy to try and answer general questions about procedure. Again, I'm not going to speak about any of the substance of the allegations or the discipline, but if you have specific questions about procedure that I think I can answer, I'm happy to try and do that. And then I do have a motion that I'm going to ask someone to make when that discussion is finished.
All right. Thank you. Jeff.
Just so I'm clear, who will preside over this hearing? Like the judge, who is that person?
The chairman of the committee serves essentially as the presider of the hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff, Kent.
Okay, so let's just...
Hello. So let's just talk about the procedure. Can you, why was this not followed with an independent hearing officer? I mean, is this an employment issue like we've had in the past? I mean, I'm not asking for specifics,
no,
but I'm asking for...
Yep.
Okay.
No, that's a valid question. I should have said I apologize. Because we're dealing with law enforcement, it's a different set of rules.
Okay.
Unique to dealing with law enforcement.
Okay. Because you said we would be doing it like to make it consistent with others. With our employees, and this is not consistent because this is not how we've done it in the past.
And if I said that, I may have spoken somewhat in error. Like I say, there's a different procedure dealing specifically for law enforcement officers, not only in the statute but in our ordinance.
Okay.
And as far as I'm aware, this is the first time since I've been involved with the board that we've had an instance like this involving law enforcement.
Okay, is this going to be set, Mr. Chairman, is this going to be set up as its own night, its own time, or is this part of another meeting?
Well, it's up to you, and you know, we could do it as part of the next meeting, but that is all a month away. My suggestion is that we set up a separate time, perhaps meet at 6:30, and can set a deadline. I don't know if you, how long do you think this is going to take, Joe? I mean, is this something that from 6:30 until 9, 10 o'clock we're going to be done?
I don't know for sure. Again, you and I will have a better idea when we have that conversation on Monday.
Right.
I would suspect that we should probably anticipate at least a couple of nights if we're only going to go for, say, 3 or 4 hours.
Okay. So Monday, we're going to talk with the attorneys at 4:45, I believe it is.
Correct.
And maybe we can get a times estimate there. And maybe we'll have to meet for a couple of times, just going to like midnight, as long as you, I don't think that's very productive or fair. I'd rather see it go from 6:30 till, let's say, 9 o'clock and come back another day when you're fresh. I think you get a better outlook. Monica.
Through the Chair to Corporation Council, is this going to be a public?
No.
Or is it going to be an executive?
Go ahead.
My anticipation is that we would go into closed session. The law allows us to do that, and I can advise that the counsel for the employee has requested it. He has no right to demand it, but he has requested that we do this in closed session, and that would be my preference as well.
Because that has been past practice when we've been dealing at finance with employee issues, correct?
Yes. Yeah. The open meetings law specifically has an exemption for dealing with disciplinary issues. So.
The general rule is open meeting. The exception is closed meeting for a personnel issue.
Correct, yes.
The employee requests of myself through his attorney a closed session. We're not obligated to do that, but I think it's important to know what the law is. I'm not saying I think it should be open, but I think it's important for us to know what the law is. And I think it's fair to say that the general rule is open, the exception is, and we can close it in our discretion. So I'm kind of anticipating it would be closed, but that's unless somebody else feels different. Anyone else? Ron?
Yeah. It's my understanding that the employee has a right to request an open or closed meeting.
Can you speak in the mic? Because
I've handled a few of these at my mic's on.
Yeah, but we can't hear you.
I handled a few of these at Gateway, and that's how it is. The employee has a choice of whether he wants it private or whether he wants it, you know, closed or open.
It's a little counterintuitive. As the chairman was saying, the law, the open meetings law presumes that it will be open. We are allowed to close it or to take a vote to close it for purposes of dealing with employee discipline. If we are going to do that, we have to give the employee the right to essentially object and request that it be open. It's weird. The employee has no right to insist that it be closed. They do have a right to insist that it be open.
From my perspective, we had one at Gateway. The guy decided to do it open, but it gets to be a circus if you do that. And so my feeling for myself, I would support a motion to have it closed.
Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My only other suggestion I'd make at this point in juncture is to set up one, two, or three dates consecutively, or whenever you feel that everyone on this committee is on board with. And if you need to cancel one because you get it done, well, then you cancel. But I think you should do multiple dates versus just one.
Okay. So let's say we start at 6:30, our usual time. What time would you want to end? Okay, is that consensus?
Fine.
So we'll inform them, Joel, Monday, 6:30 till 9:30, and we can do it one. We can set a time limit on this as well.
But we don't have a date yet.
Pardon?
We don't have a date yet.
No, I'm not. I'm just telling you what your parameters are. So if we're going to talk to them on Monday, would you want to have then the meeting the following week? Or do you want it next week? But that doesn't really give them much time, or anybody time to assemble.
Yeah, some of it depends on how much time they want. The procedure is that upon the delivery of the complaint to the employee, they have 48 hours to request in writing an appeal or an appeal hearing. Once that is received, the committee then has 5 days to schedule at least the first date, the first hearing, and that has to be within 21 days of the receipt of the request.
Well, do you want to meet before the county board meeting on Tuesday? Well, we have a committee of the whole, don't we? What, do you want to meet at 7:15, perhaps? This is only going to take a few minutes. And then set the date, or do you want to set that now?
What would be the purpose of us meeting him?
To set the date.
If we can get a date from them, yeah, okay, I guess that's okay.
Mr. Chairman.
You want to meet John?
I just have a question, procedure. If we're functioning as the jury, will we get an opportunity to deliberate? And if so, do we all have to agree on a decision like a normal?
The easy part of that question is yes, you'll have the opportunity to deliberate. That also will be in closed session. In terms of does it have to be unanimous, that is not the sense that I have. I believe that it would have to be a majority decision. It obviously would be preferable if the committee could come to a consensus, but I don't know that it is. I don't know that it's a requirement as far as anything that I've been able to ascertain.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, quick question to that. So you're not sure if it has to be unanimous or not, right? Is that something we'll have
I will have an answer before, okay, before it begins, but I haven't found anything in the statutes that says that it,
okay,
has to be.
And so, then a follow-up to something earlier. You have never experienced this before in your tenure, but to your knowledge, there has been an issue like this in the past, correct?
Certainly there have been.
Is there something that we can reference for some guidance or a template?
Ooh, based on that, I can not? Certainly look to see. Again, I'm to the best of my knowledge, at least in any kind of recent memory, I don't think Kenosha County has handled one of these. I say that in part because we had a situation a few years back where we were looking to fire a member of the Sheriff's Department and realized we couldn't without going through this process, and we'd all sort of scratched our heads. So, because again, it just hadn't been done. But I certainly will look and see if I can find something.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there is a case. It's called Leipzig. It's a long time ago. Jim Funk was the chairman.
One other question, Mr. Chairman.
What's that?
I have another question.
Yes, go ahead.
This decision that we'll end up making at the end is what the discipline right now, and what I read in the paper, is that he was reduced from a captain to a lieutenant. I mean, a sergeant. Are we locked in to that, or are we locked? Are we able to, if we decide during after hearing the evidence, if we decide it should be less than that or whatever? But the maximum we can do is what they already did, right?
I believe, again, based on the language of the statute, that once it comes to this committee, the committee could decide anywhere from doing nothing to imposing a termination, even if that was beyond what the department did.
Okay. Just for that's clear, so we're not, because the cases that we had with the union people, we were locked in to, like, one employee was discharged, and we were told, and at that time, and that was, you know, with Brookside, if you remember that, and some of us wanted to do something, but we didn't want to fire the person, you know, in that kind of discussion, but we were told that we either had to do everything that the county had done and put in place, and she'd be fired, or she'd put back to, we didn't have a choice, we couldn't amend it, we couldn't say, like in this case, from what I picked up in the newspaper, and unfortunately on Facebook, which I hope wish it wasn't been on there, but that we can reduce it or we can amend it. Is that right?
That is my belief. Yes.
Okay, that's all I want to know.
Yeah. You're going to be representing us. You're going to be dealing with us.
Yes.
And so we can't have any vagueness when we get questions. You know, like, I haven't seen that, or that. I mean, we need to know so that we're not making a mistake when this comes down. And I know this is early, but, you know, we need to know for sure what we can and can't do and what the procedures and policies are so that we don't get tripped up later. So I just want to throw that out there. So, do you want to set the meeting dates tonight?
Could I suggest a week from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Would we be better off finding what the attorney, I mean, or are we just going to do it and say you'd be there?
Yes.
His attorney, is that it? Okay.
That's what I'm suggesting. If you want to wait for input, we'll...
Well, you're going to meet with the attorney.
Yes, Tuesday. Monday, I'm sorry, Monday at 4:45. Yes.
Tuesday the
24th, 25th, 26th? Yes. 6:30 till 9:30. I'm good. Each day is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yes. There's no county board that Tuesday, so. And where would you like to meet? Here? Administration building?
Yeah. According to Biden, we can have a meeting and don't have to have 6 feet and all that other stuff. So I guess we can go back to the administration building next week if we want to.
Okay.
For
so
our meeting.
So you want to have this in the county board chambers? Is,
yeah.
Well, certainly is that. Well, we.
What do you think? I mean, if I may, I certainly appreciate the sense of the committee and would take that in consideration. I think the where is less important tonight than the when. I think the where can be determined in the next couple of weeks.
Right.
I agree.
John?
24th.
Is that good for you?
Yeah, I have another meeting I have to be at.
All right.
What time is
6:30 till 9:30. Well, do you want to meet the 20 Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 25, 6, and 7? That's okay with me. So, shall we put that date down? Then Tuesday, starting 25th, 26th, and 27. At 6:30, and do you want Joe and I to figure out where? I think you want to have it small enough so that
it's
easy to hear.
You know, it's a place where it's private. You're going to want a closed session.
Okay. All right. So, somebody want to move that the committee then will meet for the purposes of this disciplinary hearing on May 25th, 6th. And 27th, starting at 6:30, concluding at 9:30 each night.
I'll make that motion.
All right, is there a second?
Right.
All right. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. That concludes that.
Then, Mr. Chair, I do have, again, another motion essentially prepared that I would ask if the discussion is finished. I don't want to cut off discussion, obviously. But
no, go ahead.
Thank you. I'd ask the committee if in agreement for someone to make the following motion, approving the delivery of the complaint pursuant to Wisconsin statutes section 5926 sub 8 sub b 2 and authorizing the committee chair with the assistance of the corporation counsel to take any and all steps necessary to comply with requirements under the state statute and county ordinance, including making appropriate plans for the scheduling of and procedures for any hearing held subsequent to the receipt of an appeal pursuant to Wisconsin Statute Section 5926 sub 8 sub b 3 and handling any necessary pre-hearing discussions.
All right, is there someone who'd like to adopt that language in the form of a motion? Monica?
So moved. Unless he wants to hand me the paper, and I'll gladly read it into the record.
That's unnecessary. I think you're adopting what he said.
I do.
Was there a second? Dad?
Yeah,
Ron? Yes, Jeff.
So, in that dialogue that you just read off, it said that you and the chairman could set meeting times.
That's been done. So, if you want to strike that part, that's fine. I mean,
yeah, it's been done, but I also don't want to have it. I mean, we're the committee. We need all of us here if we're going to be a jury to something. So you guys can't set something without our approval. So, yeah, I'd like to strike that out of there.
Yeah, it's set to 25, 6, and 7.
I understand that, but what if you and him decide to change it to a different day?
Oh, we weren't going to.
Well, you may.
No, you, I mean, we've decided that, so. But you can strike it.
Okay,
is there a second?
Or, I'll second.
All right.
The strike.
Is there discussion? All those in favor say aye. Of the striking of that language, say aye.
Aye.
All right. Any other discussion on the motion, Joe?
So the committee is aware. When I drafted this language earlier today, I didn't know if the committee would have already set dates. That was the only reason that I put that in there. I certainly didn't mean to offend Supervisor.
All right. Anything else on this motion as stated now? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. That's anything else, Joe, on that?
No.
And then on the issue of open meeting, closed meeting, do you want to make that decision now, or do you want to wait until we get a formal response from the employee?
The way I view it, and again, I will defer to the committee, the feeling that I have is that it is the sense of the committee that it should be closed, and that again has also been the request of the employee. If I am misreading the sense of the committee, please let me know. But if that is in fact the consensus, my intention would be to simply put on the agenda the appropriate language to potentially go into closed session. The committee would still have to vote at each session to do that or not.
All right. That sounds fair.
Do you want a motion that we do this in closed session?
I think
that motion right now. This should be done in closed session.
All right. Discussion on having it in closed session. All right, seeing no discussion, I believe that requires a roll call vote,
It does, and I think we would still have to make that, I think we would have to take that vote at each meeting individually anyways, but again, I certainly would view that as directive to yourself and myself as to how to proceed.
Okay, why don't we start voting then by calling the roll. John?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
Monica?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, that's unanimous. Anything further on this issue?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you for coming and advising us. And are you now going to distribute that booklet? I have a copy myself at the office, so I don't need one.
We'll provide it to the other members of the committee.
All right. And this is confidential to the committee only, right?
Until otherwise advised, yes.
All right. Who is going to distribute that?
Oh, okay, I didn't see it. All right, very good, thank you.
All right, if there's...
No, I should do that.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Thanks, Mr. President.
All right, very good. Thank you. And he, the Corporation Council will deliver that to Sergeant Beth. All right, nothing further on item number 6. We'll move on to 7, the Cava Report First Quarter 2021 update. Go ahead, Brock.
Thanks, Chair Rose. Brock Portilla, Director of Finance from CABA, here to report on the 2021 first quarter loan reports. Kind of jump right in here on the EDA revolving loan fund report. You'll see for the first quarter, there is no new loan activity. The second page is a summary of the active loans within that portfolio. I will note that CABA was awarded a $3.6 million grant through the EDA, as part of the CARES Act program. That does not show up on any reports right now because it is pending. We don't receive any of the funds until the money is actively loaned out. There was a loan approved to Vonco Products in the amount of $800,000. As that money starts to turn over and become active, you will see this new loan fund on the report. On the next page, the county revolving loan fund. Again, you'll see no new loan activity for the quarter, but there is a outstanding commitment of $500,000. If you go down one more page, sorry. The outstanding commitment of $500,000 pertains to the Nexus Pharmaceuticals project out in the Prairie Highlands Corporate Park, and we anticipate funding that within the next 30 to 60 days. The next page, the CKC revolving loan fund. So here's kind of one just to bring your attention to. So you'll see that that account is zeroed out here for the quarter. I've spoke about this in the past. This pertains to the CDBG funds that the county had, the community development block grants. There was a closeout program from the state of Wisconsin that's been active for the past probably 2 years or so now. So those funds were frozen and subject to this closed program. The closed program was executed in the first quarter of 2021. So you're probably asking what happened to these funds. So as part of the closeout program, we were mandated to move the funds and the notes receivable out of the CKC RLF. As part of that, they moved over into a segregated fund that we hold at CABA within the CABA RLF. It's a completely unrestricted fund. These funds are now 100% defederalized. And those will, I guess those will sit there, but CABA is working with county staff on how to report these funds in the future. This part of this program was basically we had to find an allowable use for these funds in order to put the funds to work in order for CABA to maintain them and keep them. If we didn't find an allowable use, all $5.2 million of the fund, or 5.1, 5.2, give or take, had to be returned to the state. So we would have completely just wiped it off of the balance sheet and we would have lost all of that power. You've probably seen in the paper that the project that we had approved by the state is in partnership with the Village of Pleasant Prairie. It's a infrastructure project as part of a elimination of slum or blight, which is a qualifying use under the CDBG program. So it was really a case of we were just trying to find, we had to find a case where we could put these funds to use and keep them. In total, what you'll see here, and we have clean accounting records of everything that was moved over, but at the end of the day, approximately $2.25 million of cash was moved over to the CABA revolving loan fund. And there was about $2.82 million of notes receivable that were previously outstanding. Those all get transferred over. So it's really just a segregation of accounts. The funds will still be held for the same usage of economic development, but we lose all of the federal restrictions, and it's really just local restrictions now at this point. So that's a hugely beneficial project to CABA on different allowable uses. That was a very hard fund to put to use in the past, as we've talked about plenty of times. Lastly, on the high impact loan fund, a couple of things to point out. So you'll see $200,000 of loan principal and interest received. That was a repayment from Kennel Manufacturing that was outstanding. They had dipped below the job performance number in year number three. So that was basically a pro rata payback for that. They will still have years four and five to where we'll monitor performance of the job reports, where that they may or may not then earn forgiveness for those years. We also have two notes, the $150,000 outstanding. $50,000 of that pertains to the Nexus Pharmaceutical project, and $100,000 relates to the Stabio North America project, where they built a new custom manufacturing building out in the Salem Business Park. A couple other items to note. CABA recently wrapped up their annual financial and single audit reports. I know Patty Merrill is here in attendance. She sits on the CABA Audit Committee as well. think the, but the key takeaways there on the financial report, no issues, no findings, no significant deficiencies or material weaknesses, which, you know, ultimately means what I'm reporting to you as the county board here on a quarterly basis is accurate, which I suppose is nice to know. and then also, you know, CABA is subject to a single audit, an annual single audit. The single audit is more of a compliance audit on the loan side of things, making sure that we're abiding by all of the various loan contracts that we have with the respective governing bodies. So kind of bottom line was we got the thumbs up there, which is certainly the expectation on our end. Lastly, just want to present an update on the disaster recovery microloan program that I've mentioned in the past. So you may recall that CABA was awarded up to $4 million of disaster recovery microloan funds from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Those were to be administered to businesses that suffered physical damage from the civil unrest back in August. To date, we have awarded $2.8 million of the $4 million possible to 56 total businesses. We had 1 year from the award of those funds to administer the program. We executed that contract in October of 2020, so we still have about five months left to administer the remaining 1.2. We continue to work with companies. We're really kind of doing these in batches or rounds, so to speak. And so at this point, we continue to knock on doors and try to contact the individuals or the businesses that were impacted. And help get the application materials together. So, and we'll continue to do that until we either run out of money or run out of time. So, I'll stop there and answer any questions. Brian,
you said you helped how many businesses now?
For the DRM program, there have been 56 total businesses.
Is there any chance that we could see a list of that?
Certainly. Yes.
It would be nice to have some information just for the committee and anybody else, obviously.
So the individuals, if they've been, for example, displaced, they had an apartment home on, for example, 22nd Avenue, 63rd Street, they can come to you and say my loss is and obtain a grant, if that's accurate.
So we have a contract with the WEDC. It is for... Sorry, was I muted? Did you hear me okay?
No, I can hear you.
Okay. Oh, sorry. I thought the light popped off there.
Sorry.
So it's not for residential. It's for businesses. But we have a contract with the WEDC. It had to suffer some type of physical damage or inventory loss, theft, etc. But yeah, I guess we would work with the individual business themselves to make sure that they qualify for the, in terms of the contract that we have with the WEDC. But yeah, certainly if they're eligible, they can receive an award of up to $50,000. And the terms of the contract that our committee kind of determined and we worked through at the WEDC, up to 50% of that would be forgivable based on a couple of metrics. The remaining portion of the loan is a 0% interest loan, no payments for 6 months, and then the remaining amount would be amortized over 5 years.
Further discussion? Is there a motion to receive and file the report?
So
further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, thank you, Brock.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is Sheriff's Department resolution regarding 2020 grant award Homeland Security, and that will be presented by
Lieutenant Steve Moran.
All right, thank you. If you feel you can present better without the mask, go ahead and do so.
Thanks, sir. Like I said, my name is Lieutenant Steve Moranis. From the Sheriff's Department. I am the Bomb Squad Commander. I'm here to present a grant award that's been awarded to the Bomb Squad through Wisconsin Emergency Management. This is a Homeland Security grant. The grant award is $4,600. It's specifically to be used for explosive training. It'll be held in Will County, Illinois, The $4,600 will be used to cover registration costs and travel costs. There is no local match for this grant, and that's about all I have. If you have any questions.
All right, is there a discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, thank you.
Thank you. And
I will circulate the resolution here for signature. The next item is Human Resources resolution to approve the appointment of Steve Bostrom to the Housing Authority. Is he here? Steve here? No.
No.
All right, go ahead. Yes.
Good evening. I am Ashley Letterman with Kenosha County Human Resources, introducing two resolutions this evening, both to reappoint. The first one being Mr. Steve Bostrom to the Kenosha County Housing Authority Board. And then our second resolution is for Ms. Kimberly Bruning to also reappoint her to the Kenosha County Housing Authority Board.
All right. Discussion, anyone?
I will approve Steve Bostrom.
All right. Second, any discussion on that appointment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's unanimous, and I will circulate this resolution on Mr. Bostrom. And is there a motion with respect to Kimberly Bruning? Is there a second? All right, discussion. And she's not here either this evening, as you know. All right. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, that passes, and thank you. The next item is 2021 Juvenile Placement Update. Ron Rogers, are you going to present that?
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. So Supervisor Gens had asked us to give updates on placements quarterly, so that's what we are doing here tonight. And before Ron starts his presentation, I'm going to show where we are through March. So this is kind of a spreadsheet that I've shown many times quarterly, and it goes over what we budgeted and then where we are actually running. So like I said, this is through March. If you could scroll down just a little bit. So right now through March, we are projecting an overage of 372,000. And so in this first column, this is what we budgeted. We used to budget by days. Now we've changed it to number of children in placements. So we budgeted 301 children in placements daily. And we are running right now at 269. This is through March 31st. So we are under in total kids in placements by almost 32. So we have a savings there of 232,000. Then we also have to budget the rates. So rates depending on type of placement. And it all depends on the type of care and level of care that they need. So as you can see, these different placements have different rates as to where we're actually running through March 31st. Our over budget with the rates is 324,000. When we straight line this out for 2021, right now we are looking at, we need an additional 373,000. So, you know, we are also gonna be starting our 2022 budget, and we did add, I wanna say we added 800,000 in the 2021 budget for placements. So this is the number we're gonna be looking at when we're looking at our 2022 budget, because we're going to be starting that the end of this month, next month. This is our best information that we have at the time. That's it. Any questions on the financial aspect? Yes, Mr. Gens.
Jeff.
Mr. Chairman,
is there when is there fluctuation in the rates that we have to pay for these? Because I mean, to be down and nail the number of children and be below that and then have an overage of that, what can you explain that to me?
Yeah, it's all, I mean, Ron probably can explain it better, but it's all based on level of care. So how much care they need, how much therapy they need, where they're being placed, what facility they're being placed at. A lot of facilities in Wisconsin don't take higher level need care. So we are looking, we place them outside of the state.
Is that what happened when we had to send that one to New Jersey?
Yeah.
Are we still paying for that?
That kid is still living in that facility in New Jersey. He's in receiving treatment there. He's under a court order to be placed there. But what you're looking at here is, if you look at treatment foster care, for example, we budgeted to have 42 kids in treatment foster care throughout the year. And we budgeted that the rate would be at $140 a day. But the treatment rate is determined by the treatment needs of the child, and the state sets the formula for that. And we have less kids in treatment foster care than we budgeted, which is great, which saved money. But the kids that are there are needier. They score higher in what they need, the type of treatment. So the rate that we're being charged for those kids, and these are all private agencies, the formula we follow is set by the state of Wisconsin. And so that, when you look at that across that line, they more or less cancel each other out in that one category. So we have less kids in care, which is doing the good work that we should be doing. We're paying more for the kids that are in that category, though. And at the end of the day, the savings of less kids, but the cost per child being more, if it went all the way across, they even each other out. And the other thing that, and so in our residential care center, we budgeted for 11 kids. We are at a lower rate. That one kid in New Jersey distorts the rate dramatically. And literally, if you take how many kids are there right now, and you just do a simple math, you know, the right now today we have 9 children in residential care. That one kid in New Jersey throws off that average rate dramatically.
You think?
Yeah, no, I know he does. Yes. I'm not being joking about it or anything.
It's a problem. Is there anything we can do about that?
Well, the kid's making progress, and we'll be bringing, you know, as he gets to a level of treatment where he can be returned home, we want to get him home. That's the whole goal of this. He's a significantly disabled child, and he can't do what I'm doing now. He can't talk to you the way you and I are talking. He communicates with him. An adaptive device. So, you know, you point at pictures. He's a big kid for his age. He can be aggressive, very aggressive. He's on the autism spectrum disorder. He's got some low IQ. So he's got a variety of needs. His mother parented him in her home his entire life, and she petitioned the court to get help with this kid, and the judge determined that we should help this kid.
When I asked about this back at budget time, we talked about looking at other locations that are closer.
Yes.
And COVID being a problem. And now since Mr. Biden has said everything's getting back to normal, is there any way that we could bring him closer? Or do we just need to leave him there? That's the best bet. I mean,
no, that's
and do we see an end to this?
I mean, yes. Our goal would never be to see this child grow up in the facility in New Jersey. Our goal would be as he makes enough progress to get him home. If mom isn't quite ready to handle him yet, we would find a facility closer to Wisconsin or in Wisconsin that would accept him. Now, the good news is they made some breakthroughs with this kid in April. There's a meeting with the parents and the facility and our case manager. It may have occurred last week or it's occurring this week to talk about realistically what does mom need to do to get trained on how to use this new communication device and what support she needs. We have supports in this community to help her in her home, but she may need what we often call like a step down, meaning a less level of care that could help him while she gets more and more time with him and then eventually go home. So that's the goal. The goal is that he is not raised in an institution, and that's never been the goal.
How often does the state change the formulas?
The formula for treatment foster care, that's been set now for about 10 years. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Then how are we missing the number?
It has to do with the number, the needs of the kid, how they score. So you know, when you see,
so we can't predict what the needs of the kid will be. We're just going on kids and guessing at,
well, we're doing
what
our best
level of care some might need. I mean, so it's the total.
Yes, we're trying to make our best professional judgment on what the kids need. When you get to the higher levels, like in juvenile corrections and in group home care, a number of the facilities have tacked on additional costs this year because of COVID. So they've done their rate plus a rider on top of that because of all the extra cleaning and all the, or social distancing, everything they've had to do. That's happened in our detention center, corrections, and most of the group homes that we work with.
And you said that it's going to be 800,000 you're putting in there next year instead of, I mean, you're looking at the 372 and you're throwing 800 in there?
No, that's how much we added in for the 21 budget. I just wanted you to know, yeah, that we are adding as we need to, and we're not just letting, yeah, it stay at one flat rate.
Well,
thank you.
Yeah.
John.
Yes, thank you. So why don't we have a residential care center in Wisconsin?
Oh, we do. We have many. We don't have as many as we used to. We have facilities. I can list them off. There's one in Eau Claire Academy we've often used, Tommy Home, Norris Adolescent Center, Ladd Lake. We have one that used to be called St. Rose for Girls.
So they're just filled up? Is that why,
yes,
we had to send them to
community? Yes. They're filled up. That's a great question. So let me give you a little longer answer. Over the last 10 years, the number of residential centers in Wisconsin has shrunk. Those are all privately run. Those are like private corporations. So there are less beds, so to speak, available. And the demand, though, is still pretty high for those facilities. So what you're finding is that the centers that are still open, like there's a center for the kid that's in New Jersey, using that example, there's a center called, it used to be called Oconomowoc Developmental Training Center. They're called Genesee Lake School. They work with developmentally delayed kids. We referred this kid there. They said no, they couldn't meet his needs. There's another facility in northern Wisconsin called Chilita. We referred that kid there. They said we can't help this kid. And so as the number of places have shrunk a little bit, there are less choices. And because the need's about the same, so we're not the only county that has kids out of state. Other counties have been impacted by this.
You know, that was the closest state, Illinois, or?
There was a facility in Illinois that said they thought they could meet his needs, but they did not have any openings or any openings in the foreseeable future. And the other place that did was this place called Bancroft in New Jersey.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Further discussion? Does that conclude the report?
That concludes my portion. Ron is going to go into his portion now, talking about the different,
right,
placements.
Ron?
Yeah. Let me get this, pull this up here for us. Great. Okay.
Sure. Thanks.
Okay. So this is a report I prepared for the Human Services Committee. I know we don't have as much time, so I'm going to go through this somewhat quickly. I'm going to speak primarily about the items that are listed in red, but if you have any questions about anything in this presentation, I'd be happy to answer that. The question was really raised, how do kids end up in court-ordered out-of-home care? And there's really two broad categories of children we work with. Those are children in the child welfare system and children in the, or youth, I should say, in the youth justice system. So in the child welfare system, those kids are victims of child abuse and neglect. We receive a call saying that one or more children are being abused or neglected. If the allegation meets statutory standards, it's assigned to a social worker and we launch an investigation. We call that an initial assessment. All the during that initial assessment, we go out to the home, We see every child living in the home. We see every adult in the home. For children that can speak, we interview them. We interview all the adults in the home. We physically look at the makeup of the home. Is it safe? We make collateral contacts. During this initial assessment, which can take days to complete, we're always assessing for the safety of children. If during that initial assessment we determine there's present danger or impending danger for the children and we can't control it in the home, then we contact juvenile court intake services. We give those facts to them and we request a temporary physical custody order. If our facts meet the statutory requirements, JCI authorizes the emergency physical custody order for these kids, and we place kids into foster care or relative care through that court order that evening or that afternoon. And that is how the majority of the kids in the child welfare system end up in foster care. Now, the very next business day, we are in intake court, and we are presenting the same facts to the court commissioner, and he is making a legal determination that the facts exist, that we have a legal temporary physical custody order, and then we work with our partners in the district attorney's office to then petition the court saying we're going to go in, this family will now be in the court system. Go ahead.
Moving back a slide, how many people do we have doing those assessments?
We have 11 social workers.
We have 11 doing this.
We have 11 social workers doing the initial assessment investigations.
And how many calls for these initial assessments in a certain time period would you say?
Great, good question. So we probably do. We have 11 social workers trained to do initial assessments. 9 are doing them at any given time. We average 60 initial assessments a month.
60 a month.
And so in an average year, we will complete 730 initial assessments, but not all of those end up with kids in care. So
I get it.
Yeah, no. So for example, in 2019, which is like more of a normal year, let's not last year, we completed 805 initial assessments. 93 families came into the formal court system out of those 805. So think of 805 families that we went out, did the initial assessment. Of those 95 families, how many kids per family? On average, a little over 2. So 90 families equals about 180 kids. It's really close to 2. It, you know, everyone always thinks about the family with a lot of kids, but there's a bunch of families with just one child. So it averages to a little over 2. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So once we're in the court process, the various court hearings occur. We're following Chapter 48, the Children's Code. All of the individuals here on slide 2 can attend these court hearings. Eventually, through many court hearings, the court determines it, the case transfers to one of the branches of circuit court. We commonly refer to that as juvenile court. And the court determines that the children are in need of protection and services. And they issue an order maintaining the kids in out-of-home care. And they issue conditions of return. That is what the parents need to do to make a safe home for their children. And that order is issued for each child till age 18. That is typical throughout Wisconsin. During this time, I'm not going to read all these other bullets, but this is the lion's share of the work that we do on slide 3. While these kids are in foster care, we're providing services for the kids to respond to any treatment needs or trauma they experience. We're providing all of these services for the parents to make sure that they are improving their whatever is going on in the home, and we're getting to the underlying issues that makes their home unsafe. And it's during this time, while kids are in foster care, that foster parents report to us when we have kids with significant treatment needs, and meaning their behavior is sort of out of control, they're not doing well in the foster home, things aren't going well, they we will try to bring in more services to help those kids, but we may end up requesting to move a child to a treatment foster home because they'll get more intensive treatment there, or a residential care center or a group home. Yeah.
What percentage of foster care children get adopted?
That's a great question. I'm just thinking of our last report. So in 19, I believe we had just under 20% of the kids were adopted. We normally average about 72 to 75% of the kids end up going home safely to a parent. The parents make the changes that they need to. Yeah, the majority is, vast majority is 72, 75% go home safely with a parent. It changes every year a little bit. The other big group then, we go through a termination of parental rights so that they can become adopted. And that's about 18% or so. And the small percentage in between is a guardianship, which is often for older kids.
Foster parents often adopt.
Yes, yes. Okay. Most adoptions in the child welfare system are the same foster parents that have cared for him for years.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question. Although there's an order that these kids are in care till they become adults, the court reviews the progress of the parents and the children every 6 months. And that's called through a permanency plan process. And that's to encourage the parents. So it is not uncommon for kids in foster care in the child welfare system to be in out-of-home care, in foster care, or in relative care for a year, year and a half, 2 years. Those are common numbers. But at some point, if the parents are making progress, and they're making significant progress that the court believes they are safe parents, we can make a request to the court to return the kids to one or both parents. If the court agrees, they change the court order, the kids are sent home, and there's a new order put in place that we continue to supervise the case, and it's called 12-month order with conditions of continued placement in the parent's home. Then that case is wrapped up in court generally, but we're still working with those families for another 12 months. And these are our ongoing social workers. This is a different unit that is, you know, that has been working on since slide two. It's a different group of social workers. They've gotten to know these parents now for a year and a half to 2 years, and they continue working with them for the 12 months the kids are in the home. They continue to provide services and support, and they're always monitoring safety.
So those are like the ones who check out the family. They're more like the family,
yeah,
social workers. How many of those do you have?
14.
14.
Yeah. So they that investigation piece only lasts about, it lasts no longer than 2 months, but it normally lasts about, you know, 30 to 40 days by the time you wrap up all the documentation and everything. Yeah.
So you have 14 people doing this. About how many families are you working with for those 14 people?
That's a great question, too. I really thank the county board. We added staff to this unit. We used to have caseloads up to about 18 to 20 families per worker. With the added staff, and we're working to get kids in permanent safe homes, we're averaging now 14 staff at about 16 families per worker. That's our average today.
Thank you.
Yeah. And as you saw, the number of kids in regular foster care had gone down. That, from our budget, that's the work we're doing to find permanent safe homes for these kids. Again, most go home safely. And then and you remember that we had the support of the county board for project permanency to add that extra support at the district attorney's office to process more termination of parental rights cases. And that, although the pandemic made that difficult last year, we still did well with that, and it's continuing this year.
Thank you.
funny you should bring that up. It's in my notepad. So how many did, do you know how many that Mr. Gravely moved to?
We had at the end of 2020, we had 58 kids with the termination of parental rights completely finished. And another, I'm off a number or two, a number, another 25 in the court process. So they were in court filed, they were in one of the hearings. So that, if you add those two together, that was a good year. It's a good year. The pandemic slowed down the court process, there's no doubt about it. Yeah, it just did.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not going to talk about the TPR process right now, but I'll answer more questions if you'd like. I just want to talk very briefly about youth justice. So there's some significant differences. One, these are older kids, generally teenagers. They commit an alleged delinquent act. It's something that would be called a crime if you or I did it. The district attorney determines if they're going to prosecute that crime. And if they are, it goes into court. Numerous court hearings are held. And at some point in time, the court will adjudicate the youth as being delinquent. We get assigned, after that adjudication, to do an assessment of the youth to determine what are their treatment needs and what services they need. But what I want to draw your attention to is the Juvenile Justice Code, because it's a different part of Wisconsin statutes. So the focus of the Juvenile Justice Code are these three bullets: to protect the community, impose accountability for violations of the law, and equip the juvenile offender with competencies to live responsibly and productively. So there is always sort of a tug of war a little bit about these youth need treatment, guidance, those things, but there's also, we don't want the kids to break the law again, commit another crime, another delinquent act. So after we do our assessment, there's a court hearing. We commonly call a dispositional court hearing. We put in court what we think this youth needs. Most juvenile delinquents do not go into care. They are often put on an order of supervision for 9 to 12 months, and they're ordered to comply with a lot of services. That's the majority of the work happening in the youth justice unit. And that statistic on the bottom of slide 8 is from 2019. 78% of the youth justice kids that we worked with in 2019 did not commit a new offense while on supervision. We're really proud of that number. That's 8 out of 10 kids did not break the law again while they're on supervision.
How's that compared to other years?
We're normally in the upper 70s. We're good. Now, I don't know what our numbers are for the pandemic year. We're just crunching that now, meaning last year, so I'll find out. But you still see there's 22% of the kids do break the law again, and that's where kids often end up in out-of-home care, because if kids reoffend or they're just struggling or not doing well in the community, they're going to end up back in front of the judge, and the court can respond to escalating problems by ordering consequences, sanctions for the youth, but the court can also respond to escalating problems with the youth by placing a youth in out-of-home care to get greater treatment and provide greater structure for the teenager. The court will often use these top three: treatment, foster care, group home care, residential care centers, to try to get at what is the underlying issues that's causing the youth to break the law. What I want to draw your attention to is if the youth makes progress in these centers, and we work with them closely, we're going to request that the youth go back home to the parents, and those kids that do well, they're going to complete their supervision at home. But if they continue to have problems in one of these top three, that's how kids generally end up in the Alternatives to Corrections Through Education program, which is housed in the Racine Detention Center, or Juvenile Corrections, which is in Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake School for Girls. It is rare that kids get placed in those two locked facilities because of one delinquent act, although it can happen. It can happen. Meaning, if a kid does armed robbery with a gun, points a gun at somebody in Kenosha, I think every judge here will probably lock that kid up in corrections. But most kids end up in corrections because we've tried other things and it hasn't worked. Yeah. And we actually had, we have an example of what I just said this year, you know, where a kid pointed a gun, at a real gun, not a BB gun or something, and the court responded very, very firmly and said, you're going to corrections. Yeah. So that's really how they, all kids in the two groups, end up in out-of-home care. There's a lot of court oversight. There's a lot of oversight, you know, if either through the permanency plan process or in the initial hearings. And at the end of the day, we present what we think is best for the child. The court may agree. With the youth justice kids, sometimes there's three different views on what should happen with that kid. The kid's attorney, the assistant district attorney, and our county social worker. And then the judge decides. Yeah. So I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
I have a question.
Right. Yeah.
Are the parents ever held financially responsible for anything?
Yes. We almost every, on every case, we have a general rule that we order child support. So, like, if kids are in out-of-home care, there's a child support ordered by the county.
Okay, so there is some responsibility of the parents, and that's, and I don't think everybody realizes that.
Yeah. And then depending on if the kid, like in a youth justice case, if the kid has to pay restitution because they broke something or whatever, we will collect that with the kid while they're under supervision. And if for some reason we're unable to get that, you know, some kids, they don't get a job or something, the parents can be held liable for that too.
One other question. Are you continuing to have problems finding foster homes?
For the child welfare kids, because of what Supervisor Franco said about adoption, we always need new foster homes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where does One Hope fit into all that?
The One Hope program, yeah, that foster family support, they are up and running. They have 25 active foster homes they're supporting right now. I can't think of how many volunteers they have. I think it's around 70 right now. We're going to report back to the Human Services Committee either in June or July to give an update of how they're doing, but they're off to a great start. The pandemic, again, some of the foster parents didn't want as much hands-on help within their foster home, but I think that's going to change over time. They're getting it. The foster parents that are using it like it a lot. And our goal is to have 54 foster homes helped, signed up for that help by the end of this year. So we're about halfway there.
Any further discussion?
Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, well, that's thank you for the report, and we appreciate the information.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
We'll move on to the next item, number 12, status review of Parkland Development Civic Center. Is that going to be presented by Jim?
I'll do that.
Barna? Okay, go ahead.
My mic on?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. So if you would please refer to the two handouts that everyone was provided at their desk there. One is titled Parkland Development, and the other one is Civic Center Development. So these are two reconciliations that Finance prepared. These are in response to a request by Supervisor Gentz regarding other funds that were available that are used for capital projects for the county. So the first one I'd like to go through is the Parkland Development Fund. It shows a beginning balance as of January 1st on 2020 of just short of $1.5 million. The majority of that is from the ATC funding that we got, $1.3 million. It shows some other revenues that flowed into this separate fund. It's Fund 420 on our books. And it shows the expenses that were expended from that. And then there was a transfer for parks projects to Fund 411. So the funds reside in Fund 420 until they're given a landing place or a capital project in Fund 411. So as of the end of the year 2020, there's an undesignated fund balance basically of $678,000. So projecting forward in 2021, we're projecting waste management funding to draw to go into this fund, Beer Garden and a Boundless Adventures of $100,000, Paddock Lake easement dollars going into there, and some of the expenses that were budgeted in 2021 include the South Pike and North Pike projects, projecting spending or spend down or adding to our sinking fund for the Pets building in Petrified Springs, and then there's a Pets Pike River project. So with that, we're expecting a projected end balance as of 12/31/21 of $263,000 approximately,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. So why don't you walk me through how this is funded and how, you know, I see the little revenues, but we're spending more than that. So how do we bring money into this? What triggers us spending money out of it? And how is the flow? Explain this to me.
Okay, so obviously the largest component of revenue that came to this was the 1.3 of ATC money that we received back in 2019. The other forms of revenue that flow into this would be waste management, monies that we receive from waste management for tipping fees. Then the Beer Garden and Boundless Adventure revenue that we receive from those programs. And then as we identify projects, capital projects, either through the budget process or through a budget resolution that would come before this committee, that's when it would be determined how that funding would be spent.
So obviously we're not going to get that big transfusion of money regularly.
No.
So usually this fund has, you know, to start with the revenues about $200,000, $250,000.
Right. It actually started with that ATC lease, ATC monies, and then it was determined to have these other smaller dollar amounts also supplement that large dollar. So to answer your short answer to your question is yes. Once we get to the end of the year, we'll just have these other small dollar amounts flowing into this, unless we get another large influx of revenue.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. If there is no other questions, then I'll direct your attention to the other reconciliation that was provided. It's the Civic Center Development Fund. This is within Fund 411, but it's a separate fund. And this, if you recall, was begun probably 5, 6, maybe 7 years ago even, where we take advantage of properties in the Civic Center when they become available for future expansion and for development within the Civic Center campus. So as of the end of this, of 2020, we had $181,000 in there. So the revenue sources here are whether if we budget with an annual budget, a capital budget, typically we've been just about every year, there's been a few years where we have not budgeted $250,000, excuse me, toward this. And then there's budget resolution language that also allows for unexpended capital funds on other projects to be able to roll into this Civic Center Development Fund at the end of the year. And that's in 2021. We're expecting the repurposed of those funds would be $200,000. So the available funds would be $600,000-ish. From that, the two main capital projects that are expected in 2020, one would be the demolition of the law office and the home that are adjacent to the parking lots by the administration building, and then the expansion of that parking lot to the rest of the block, including the other law office that was purchased. It would be directly north of the law office. So with that, then those are projections at this point. I believe those projects were let, and I believe these numbers are expected to fall in that line. So with the completion of those projects, that would leave an estimated balance of about $75,000.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
So So this is something that we fund. I mean, there's nothing that brings money or revenue into this.
Right.
Where are we if we took a snapshot? Are we still, are there pieces that we want to acquire in that area?
I know in the past there was a property that was on the other block where the fleet maintenance building was. My understanding is that the price tag was too high. The owner was not cooperating, I guess you call it.
Are you seeing the need of putting a quarter million in this every year?
That typically is what we've been doing. Obviously, we've had a lot of success in being able to acquire these properties. The simulcast tower project, part of the success of that project is owed to being able to buy those homes that were in that same block with the fleet maintenance building. And so we were able to obtain those homes for around their appraisal cost, you know, and be able to do that project and have a home for that tower, which was needed based on the location of the other tower by the safety building.
Because I'm just looking at in the future, trying to cut our expenses, and I don't know what the overview of the plan is there. If there's, you know, many more buildings that we need to get, I wouldn't think there would be. We've been buying everything that's there.
In the block that's immediately west of ours, there's, I believe, one, maybe two of the storefronts that are still privately owned. Purchased the Madrigano law offices and the one that directly east of that. I believe there's been some talk about the property behind that where a couple of law offices are in that building, but my understanding is that those talks have not led to anything. But other than that, I mean, you've done a really good job of piecing together this property.
If I could add to Barna's comments, in addition to acquiring properties, there's the cost of demolition.
Yeah, there's and parking lots and towers and all other things.
Right, even those properties that he said that we own on the block to the west, if we were to acquire the additional properties, there might be a desire to demolish all to create more parking or whatever the purpose would be. So there would be need for funds in this account at that time. So each year as we're putting the budget together, that is something that's looked at, is where are we with the overall plan? How much? We used to put $300,000 into this account, and then for a while nothing was really happening with it, so we cut that back. There were one or two years where nothing was put into them, but again, that's evaluated as the budget is being prepared.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to seeing that in budget about what your plans are and what you're thinking for that. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Further comments, discussion? All right, you're not asking for any kind of action, right? All right, we'll move on then to the next item on the agenda, budget authority review discussion. That's
it. I'll take that. So this came from a question that came from at the last committee meeting regarding COVID funding and how the funds that we had received prior to this large American Rescue Plan funds, how that was handled. So I wanted to kind of talk through that. So I just wanted to reiterate to the committee that, you know, until we get these funds from the American Rescue Plan, the county has not spent any county COVID-related funding received by state or federal funds. So everything that the county has received, fortunately, we were able to receive millions of dollars of reimbursement for expenditures that the county incurred. I went through those with a report monthly last year to this committee, but a great majority of these were salary spending in the Sheriff's Department for overtime and also regular salaries for correctional officers. It included contact tracing and other activities performed by the Health Department. Hours, salary related to the facilities, cleaning the buildings, up to the level of that was needed as a result of the pandemic. And then there were hours that IT used in order to get us up and running using the teleworking, getting literally hundreds of employees like myself working at home very seamlessly from working in the office. So all these expenditures were incurred as a part of the normal budget authority within the budgets. And then as we reviewed the eligibility of these expenses that were laid out as part of the routes to recovery funds, then monthly I would report how much of the expenditures were potentially eligible and then how much we were able to draw down from that. So I just wanted to go through that. Obviously, this American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 it's a different animal. That's going to be a large influx of funding that will need direction and budget authority to spend.
All right, discussion on that? All right, seeing none, we'll then move on to the next item on the agenda. Which is the resolution for the acceptance of American Rescue Act 2021 funding. And Patty, are you going to do that?
Yes, I will speak to that. At the April Finance Committee meeting, I went through an explanation of the American Rescue Plan and the funds that Kenosha County was expected to receive. On Monday of this week, the portal was opened by the Treasury, the federal level, allowing us to apply for those funds. This resolution authorizes us to do that.
So
moved. Discussion?
I just have a quick question.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Patty, John. Any expectation on when we're going to get these, the first tranche of these funds?
What I understand is the big holdup was, in order to get them, the person submitting, which is me, had to go through an extensive identity check to prove that I was who I said I was and that I had a relationship with Kenosha County in order to request those funds. I did that part so that I could, because some people were really having some issues with that. So I got through that. From what I understand, once the application is submitted, they're saying it's taking about 4 days, but quite frankly, I know there are treasurers and finance directors throughout the state who have applied already, and so far no one has said, hey, we got our money. So I'm expecting a week or 2 weeks. Now, obviously the application would not be submitted until this resolution passes the board, which would be brought to the board on Tuesday. If it passes the board on Tuesday, I would complete the submission on Wednesday. So I would think a week or two. And again, we were expecting approximately $32.89 million. Wisconsin Department of Revenue had some new numbers, which I looked at yesterday, which showed us getting about $32.935, so it's less than $50,000 more. And again, the tranche is about 50%. So I've seen nothing from the federal government yet on exactly what that dollar amount will be. I'm kind of hoping that that's going to come through when I hit that submit button on the portal.
And that money comes directly to the county? It doesn't go through the state? Or
No, because all counties are being directly funded by the federal government and large cities. So like the city of Kenosha met the threshold of being directly funded. Smaller cities, smaller municipalities, they are coming through the state, and that money will be later.
Thank you.
So,
yes.
So we can rest assured that you're you?
Yes.
Okay. Right. I just want to clear that up.
I felt like I had to give them my firstborn son, but.
Further discussion?
I have a question. I talked to you a while back to get information on this, you said at our last meeting that this money was to not use to reduce the tax levy in any way.
No.
It had to be used for programs that the county would eventually set up. Obviously, no money can be spent until something is set up.
Right.
And what it sounded like was that it's going to take a lot of
planning,
a lot of work to set it up, like because you talked about like rent assistance and energy assistance and stuff programs that would help the community, right?
That's so that is a potential component.
Nothing's going to be spent until that thing gets in. Once the money comes in, then you're going to have to refer it to whatever social right. service agency or our agencies, I guess, because we're going to have to go internally, because I don't see us hiring people
right.
for this, because and you also said it's going to come in two payments, one
correct.
Half this year, half next year. Mm-hmm. And then we had 4 years to spend it.
Correct.
So this thing has got to go a whole long way out before yep. we even get to any spending, right?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, further discussion on the resolution. All right, seeing none, the motion was made, I believe, by Supervisor Gens, was it? And seconded by President, was it? All right. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right, that's unanimous. All right, thank you, and we'll move on then to the resolution. All right, we'll circulate this. Resolution offered by Supervisor Belsky, Berg, and Rodriguez. All of you have that, and why don't I turn it over to Supervisor Belsky to discuss and introduce.
Thank you, everyone. I want to start out by saying that our budget process is one of the most important and complex exercises that we are responsible for as county board supervisors. Being that said, the Kenosha County budget is one of the best managed budgets in the state, with a Fitch rating of AA+. In response to COVID-19 and our county facing potential unprecedented fiscal challenges, the federal government's financial assistance has been crucial to providing county services that would have otherwise faced significant challenges. The reason for this resolution is in support and to ensure that going forward, any COVID-19 pandemic issues, federal or state revenues, unforeseen emergency related programs or projects, or any expenditures or revenue received from sources not anticipated in the budget year are presented before the county board. And I'd really like to thank Barna for his review and his recommendations to this resolution. So supervisors, I ask for your support in supporting this resolution.
Discussion? Yes.
This is going to go to the board and say exactly what, but we haven't done anything with the money yet. So,
are you speaking of this?
This resolution is just saying we will follow all of the rules in the budget process. Is that what we're saying here? I mean, I don't know what we're saying in this resolution.
What it's saying.
Excuse me, I have the floor. Okay. What I'm asking is, what is this going to do to the money that we're going to get that we haven't even decided how we're going to spend it yet? Because that would almost have to come in the budget process, wouldn't it? I'm not against this. I'm just saying that I don't know what it does.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think what it does is say that when we receive that money, it needs to go through the board and be sent out that way. But I don't think it's limited to that. I think it's they made it so that it's, you know, inclusive of any money we get from COVID or you know, outside of the budget, having to come to the board to spend. So, you know, I congratulate Supervisor Belsky and Barna for working that out. And I think that, you know, this isn't specific to that one thing. I think it's more specific to, you know, anytime we get that type of money. So I hope that clears it up.
I'm not against it. I'm just saying I don't know what it does when you finally pass it, because it has to be that way anyway. But it's okay.
Well, let me ask this question, and I think that kind of dovetails what you're saying. You'd mentioned, Barna, that we'd receive money to, for example, to replenish or replace salaries of, let's say, sheriff's deputies.
We did.
Does that type of money, unexpected in the form of a grant, it doesn't come to the county board now, correct?
Correct, because that's close to a regular budget.
And your theory is that The reason it doesn't come to the board is because it's replacement of that which we've already adopted.
Correct.
And this resolution, am I correct, says the opposite, that it must come to the board to accept and replace.
This is for new programs or projects related to COVID or any other emergency type things.
So this replacement money that we're talking about for sheriff's deputy salaries, for example, that would not be coming to the board?
No.
Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Oh.
That anything that's been approved within the budget process, this resolution is for only things that are outside of the normal budget process, the budget resolution.
Well, other than this American Rescue Plan, which we just passed that, is there anything else that falls into this category?
Not that I'm aware of at this point. I believe there are some other funds that potentially could be reimbursement of, let's take for example the vaccination, the mass vaccination clinic. Those that will be reimbursement following the similar expenditures that were done last year. But in addition to that, I'm not aware of any at this time.
Okay, so you can't think of anything in the past that's in the 20 budget or 2019 or that would be affected by this, huh?
No.
Okay. Is that your understanding of the maker of the motion?
Yes, it is. What this is doing, say next year we have locusts come through and eat all the county crops and create a disaster, we might get some relief for that. Those are the kinds of situations that this resolution will cover, that money coming in that is unexpected during the budget process and during the budget year.
So without this resolution or the prior resolution, what would have happened with that American Rescue money or the vaccination, if there is such a thing?
It would have gone into a liability account. It's going to land as a deferred revenue, and then it would require the county board, either the administration would put it in a budget, or it would have to be by budget resolution to recognize the revenue and also to recognize what expenditure that would be spent on.
All right. Anyone else?
Yeah. Well, during the COVID thing, you had your health department cost went way up. So you were able to apply for grants to prove that this happened because of COVID, and then this money came in outside the budget, didn't it?
Actually, it was this money became available. They let us know that there were up to $3.5 million available to just Kenosha County. So every municipality, every county was provided a dollar amount. They said, this money is available for reimbursement.
But you had to apply.
And we spent hundreds of hours of accumulating documentation on all these different expenditures so that it would meet the eligibility of the funding. And then when we submitted it, they would review that and then make a determination on whether or not they would send us the money. And then
you got the money, and it didn't go through the budget process, it went through an administrative process, right?
Right.
So that didn't happen. You know, there was some things that I, you know, as I know this COVID thing, everybody was kind of isolated. So, but when I found out about you opening up the Shopko thing, I read it in the paper like everybody else. I never got any information from anybody. A lot of money was spent, rightfully so, to fill the holes that we would have had. I know when you got done with the final report, we had actually more reserves than when we started. So you did one good job, but money was spent that wasn't budgeted. But you had to fill holes, and you proved that you had overspent health departments because of COVID vaccines and stuff, right? So that never went through that process.
I wouldn't categorize them as overspent anything because
you're filling holes.
Expending things that normally the health department would.
I agree, but I'm just saying that if that hadn't happened, we would have a $3 million hole right now, right?
Right.
So that never went through the process, but it was okay. I was over with it. I don't think that I felt like during the process that I got enough information. Like when I said the Shopko thing opened up, I said, how did you get the money for that? I don't know if anybody else did, but I did. I was okay with it.
Right. I could say
that. A lot of that spending happened when, and it never went through the budget, but because of COVID, the money was available. So how did that happen without the board approving it?
What I could say is we could, I guess, re-engage in providing reports to the committee, similar to how we did that.
I agree, and I got a report every month. But I said we didn't go through the budget. We added to it because we had this deficit because of COVID, right?
Right. Had it not been for the reimbursement,
make any sense of that,
we literally would have drawn down millions of dollars from our general fund.
I'm not happy that it happened. I'm just saying we didn't go through the budget process. We spent money that we hadn't budgeted to begin with, right? But it was done administratively, right? With reports to the finance committee.
Right. All right, any other discussion?
Yeah.
John.
Quick question. I just want to make sure I fully understand this. I think I do, but so in other words, this money that we're receiving is going to be outside of the budget. You guys are going to, the finance department, going to come up with a budget as if we don't have this money at all, and just through the normal process, and then when we receive this money, this is just going to be used for those specific federal guidelines set down, and you decide when, if and when, within those general guidelines, what specific programs are going to be used and what percentage is going to be used in the different categories. You're going to bring that before us, and then we're going to say yay or nay, okay, spend it. But basically, yes, the budget's over here and this money's over here. And do I understand that correctly?
It could be either rolled into our regular budget process, or it could come separately in a budget resolution. Those are the two mechanisms that are in place to change a budget or
okay,
establish a
budget. But we're doing the latter?
At this point, I don't know if a decision has been made which
okay,
way we're going to go with that. We're still trying to figure out what
okay,
what we can even spend it on yet. So
once a plan is put
okay,
together, that will be brought to the Finance Committee and the Board. This money is to be expended over the next 4 years.
Okay.
So part of that plan may be to do X in 2021. Well, we already have a 2021 budget, so there would be a budget modification presented to go along with the expenditures expected in 2021. But for 22, 23, 24, it could potentially just be a component of the whole budget.
Okay. Yeah.
But let's say you decided to use that money, you set up a program for it, and you put that in this year's budget, that a certain amount of money for this year's budget to run energy assistance or whatever program you want to do. And you could probably, because you can go out 4 years, you might be able to keep them programmed to it for 3 or 4 years that you had already set up, right?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
One of the things that I keep keeping in mind is we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So we didn't expect COVID at all. We didn't expect many of the things that we ran into. So the plan that's put together is going to address larger areas, but it may need to be modified over the next 4 years based on things that happen.
Thank you.
All right, anything further on the resolution from anyone? All right, seeing none, should we take a vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next, item 16, audit of bills has taken place. We have the reports, if there are any further reports, are there? There are none. All right, that concludes the agenda before you. Is anything else to come up? Good and welfare of the committee. If not, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you.